Well, good afternoon, everyone. You probably know my name is Lou Ebert. I'm interim executive director for the Council of State Chambers, and really glad to have you on our COSC Southern Regional Economic Forum call. We've been doing these quarterly forums yesterday and then also today. Today, I believe we have 8 states on the call, so that's awesome. We have our friends from Georgia, Tennessee, West Virginia, Arkansas, Florida, South Carolina, and Kentucky. Hopefully I didn't miss anyone. Apologize if I did. Also want to thank our presenting sponsor today is Next Era Energy. Our friend Michelle Wheeler is on the phone too. So Michelle, thank you for making these forums possible. Our presentation platform, the platform we'll be using today and for ongoing Zoom calls, is being sponsored by Participate. Today's session will be recorded, so you'll have access to the video and the audio. So you and you also have access to the slides as part of the audio. And Kathy tells me it's already on the COSC website. So as we wrap up here, you'll be able to access it there. Also want to introduce Kathy Woolover. Kathy's on the call today. Kathy is part of the Council of State Chambers team. You'll be hearing more from her in the coming weeks and months, and I'm glad to have her on the team as we move into July. So now, is Ted Pitts on the call yet?
I think I just let him in.
Okay. Hey, Ted, are you on?
He just popped up.
Okay. So I'll turn it over to Ted Pitts. Ted is one of our COSC hosts for today's call, and I'll let him introduce our COSC National Economic Advisor. So Ted, the floor is yours.
Looks like he's on.
The microphone is off.
Okay. Why not just go ahead for the, that's okay. Want to introduce Ted Abernathy. Ted is no stranger to many of you. He is at least 4 decades in economic development and economic work around the country, but a lot of intensive work in the South where he's from. Ted's a native of North Carolina and for a number of years was head of the Southern Governor's Policy Board. Ted works with about a dozen state chambers around the country, helping them understand issues around competitiveness, you know, what's happening in their economy, where opportunities might present themselves. And Ted has graciously agreed to be our economic advisor for 2020 for the council. We'll be doing these quarterly briefings throughout the year. So Ted, thanks for being part of the council. Thanks for offering to help us, you know, make sense of what's going on in the southeastern region, and we'll turn it over to you. Welcome, Ted.
Lou, thanks a lot, and thanks to all of y'all who came on today. And I know many of you and worked with quite a few. What Lou asked me to do today was 3 things: do a quick reset on how COVID-19 has hit us in the last few months, take a little bit of a broader look at the economy over the last few years, and we're doing this by region. I'll go ahead and tell you now that we moved Delaware. Delaware nationally is in the South. Yesterday we moved it back to the Northeast, and so some of the data today still has it in the South, so ignore that when we bring it through. I can't believe the census data, so Delaware's decided they're a Northeastern state. We'll deal with that. And then the third thing, the thing that has injured most of the questions for the Q&A part of this, is what do we expect to happen post-COVID? And we're not going to predict the path of the pandemic. None of us, I think, have much information or very smart about knowing what comes next or where that light at the end of the tunnel is. But we will talk about what it's going to look like when we finally get there and work our way out. Again, we're doing this 4 regions. You guys are the 3rd one. We'll be doing the West later tonight. And these are the regions as defined by the U.S. Census. So everybody might remember way back in February when we were riding the end of 113 straight months of employment growth in the private sector. That was the longest in our history. Things looked pretty good. Most of the economists had come out suggesting that there would not be any recession in 2020 and maybe not in 2021. And then the pandemic hit. And in April, we ended up losing 20 million jobs. And to put that in perspective, this is what the chart would look like if you drew it to scale. It's a crazy chart, and we will be showing crazy charts from now till forever. 2020 will never be forgotten because it'll be that chart that everything pops out on. In May, we added back 2.5 million jobs, which would have been the largest job growth in history, except for these odd times. And the real balance is how many of the jobs, how many of those 20 to 30 million that were lost over the 3 months are going to be permanent losses versus temporary. And we'll talk about that a little at the end. Nationally, if you look from May of 19 to May of 20, it's about 12% of all jobs lost. But if you look below, you see that leisure and hospitality is the place where most jobs were lost. Almost half, over 40% of the jobs in the leisure and hospitality sector disappeared. Many of them were temporarily disappeared because we shut restaurants and we shut bars and we shut hotels. And so those losses were heavy. The area government lost 6%. Construction only lost about 6%. Financial services did not lose many jobs at all. And in fact, in many states, they actually gained jobs as PPP loans were being distributed around the country. So that's the overall look nationally. If you look at the four regions, you find two things that happened. And the Northeast took the biggest hits. They're the blue bar. And that's because this is through May, and they entered the COVID crisis sooner than the rest of the regions. So the South, the red bars, entered latest. And you all know that now, but the losses in the South were much lower through May in every sector. And the other sectors, other regions fall into that. If you just look at the South versus the U.S., you see that in every area, the South's jobs losses lag. Now, it'll be real interesting to see how the June numbers come in. And now, given the surge in recent months, the June, July numbers, as they come out, will probably have the South getting closer to the national average. I guess the real fear in the Northeast is that you have a resurgence like is happening in California right now. This is all 50 states, and through the end of May, it's a real mixed bag. In Hawaii, 20% of the jobs were lost. In Utah, less than 5%. So it was a real uneven. That has to do with where the surge is, how the state is laid out, what type of economy it has. If you're a state heavily reliant on tourism, on entertainment, then you're going to feel it a lot stronger than you will if you were state heavy in agriculture, let's say, or even manufacturing. This is the four regions side by side again. Again, Northeast the most, South the least. And this is all of our states. Delaware and Kentucky. Again, Delaware going to get moved next time, but those are the states with the biggest. You can see a lot of states really, though, only 7-8%, which was considerably lower than the national average through the May timeframe. So let's stop then. The hit was hard. It was rolling across the country based on where you were in the epidemic. But let's go back and reset our economy before that. So for the last 5 years, these are the five regions of the country. The United States grew at 8.4%. The South did better than that, trailing only the West. South grew at 9.4%. And these are the states in the South, led by Florida. Some places not growing much at all, some places growing very fast, and a little bit of everything. So talking about the South as a region is appropriate, but as we all know, the economies are very different from state to state. This is the five-year growth by sector for the four regions. The West is the green bar, and you can see the West excels in many areas, leading the country in every category except manufacturing, where the South leads. So this has been a last 5 years where a lot of growth has headed into the Western states. Their percentage growth has been very strong, but South still remains the strongest place for manufacturing. You look at the Northeast, just for a minute, the blue bars, strong in professional and technical services, strong in health and education, Very little growth in manufacturing, low growth in trade, very low growth in government because very low growth in population. So it is a lot that common sense would tell you that is happening across the country. The only area of concern, I think, for the South, just a little bit less in health and education, some of that having to do with policy choices, but overall strong growth across most of the South. This is how we stack up. As you can see, pretty strong in every category. We're the red compared to the rust colored there. Per capita GDP paints a little bit different story. We know that our GDP has been growing in the South quite a bit, but that's mostly driven by population growth. The South still trails the other regions in terms of output or GDP per capita. And when we look across the South, it's real uneven for states too. This is a growth in real GDP. The Delaware, when it moves, it'll get our red number out of the South's numbers. You can see some states, especially some of our states that are dependent on energy, not growing quite as fast. A couple like Georgia, Florida, Texas growing at the national average. This is per capita personal income. This is another area that our part of the country trails in. You're seeing fast growth in per capita income in the Northeast and the West, a little slower growth in the Midwest, and the South has the slowest growth overall in per capita income. We're attracting a lot of people to the South, but there are a lot of jobs that are at the lower end of the spectrum. Now, somebody asked yesterday, and we'll try to do this for the next time, we'll try to do some value of $100 assessment so that we get a little bit more about cost of living involved in this. So I think that's a legitimate question. So we'll have that the next time we go around. This is the change in personal income per capita over the last 5 years. Again, a real mixed bag. The energy sector moved down a little, so Oklahoma's numbers are low, Georgia's numbers are high, but it is, like many things when we look at southern states, a real mixed bag because while we're geographically together, our economies are quite different. You look at productivity for all 50 states across the country, you see another area of mixed. Some places almost twice others in output per worker. And when you look at productivity of the four regions, this is the output of GDP per 1,000 workers, maybe dollars per 1,000 workers. The South trails the other regions. So our output per worker, partially due to the mix of businesses that we have, but just overall tends to trail. This is our states, and so there are some higher states and some lower states as our economies are very different. The reason it matters, and something that I've been asked to go a little bit more into next time, this is mapping of our GDP, our output per capita, and our personal income. And as you can see, it is an absolutely correlated chart. The more output workers deliver, the higher the wages that they have. And you can see up at the top end are some states like New York and Massachusetts that typically we don't think of as pro-business states, but their productivity per worker in terms of pure GDP is pretty high. We have some states in the bottom end of this where, and southern states where wages are pretty low, income's pretty low, but productivity is also low. And it's a mixed bag. So the easiest way to try to raise wages in our part of the world is to try to get the productivity of the workers up. It has to do with training, investment in machinery, and that type of strategy.
Hey, Ted.
Yep.
Ted, it's Mark Wilson in Florida. Could you go back to that slide?
Sure.
So could you, as our advisor, could you coach us on sort of what goes into this? So for example, you know, we have in Florida, we have 10.5 million in our workforce, but 22 million population, 21% of our citizens are retired.
Yep.
So when you talk about per capita, is this, when you talk about personal income, is the big equalizer here that whether you're in Massachusetts or Hawaii, that this only includes those that are working?
This is per capita, so it includes both. I think your original point that you have a bunch of people who aren't working because they're retired does factor into it, Mark. But there are some other states that have pretty high retirement numbers too that fall in here. So I think it's valid to look at this. That's what I said when we started. Look at this a little deeper and look at different things. But part of it is really the type of economy that you have and what the output is of the individual worker. Every industry's output per worker is very different. So if you end up in an oil and gas industry where there's a lot of robotics but not a lot of workers and the output's real high, then you can get a false positive on this also.
Not for today, Ted. I certainly don't want to take everybody's time up with this, but just even some instruction and coaching from you, like would you rather be Scott in Mississippi or Heather in New York, right? Like, which is better and why? And, you know, what can a state chamber do about it? So maybe next time.
Yeah. And the real question mark is that, do you want to be the chamber director in Mississippi? Do you want to be the employer in Mississippi? You want to be the business in Mississippi? Right. Those are different answers, I think, as we move along. So happy to dig into it. And as I said when we started, I was asking to dig into it a little bit more yesterday, and we'll try to bring that back next time for you.
Great. Thanks.
So after COVID, what happens? When we get to that light at the end of the tunnel, the very first thing you want to say is when we get to the end, we're still in competition. The world didn't just change all the competitive numbers going forward. What people care about, what businesses care about, their access to logistics, their skilled labor access, their cost structures, their tax structures, all those things will still matter. We'll be distracted from them for the time being, but we'll get back to this, and those things will still be important. Data analytics will still be important. So when you look at rankings, if you look, people spend a lot of time talking about Forbes or CNBC or chief executive or somebody's rankings. Mark and Randy and some of you on the phone have seen me with this chart before. We look at those rankings, then we look at job performance. What's the job growth? What's the wage growth? What's the growth in GDP? And sometimes they're correlated and sometimes they're not. So down in the far left corner in the green box, those are the states that show up in everybody's top group on the rankings, but also show up performance-wise. So Mark, Florida shows up down there regularly. Utah shows up down there regularly. Arizona. Some places show up as in the bottoms of these groups. Some perform in the bottom, but there are also mixes here. Indiana shows up in performance not as well in recent years as its rankings, or Oregon shows up better performance than its rankings. You have to decide what's important, what you think the actual performance measurements ought to be, and you could add a whole bunch more in there, but trying to find the correlations between factors is what all of these type of rankings try to do. And some of them use 100, 200, 300 different individual factors. Then it's how do you weight them? We do a thing with Virginia every year with the Manufacturers Association, and we let their board determine what are the right factors and how should they be ranked. We think the businesses know a little more about what's important to them than just us as data people do. I'll give you an example of how easy it is to take some of the data and make it not look the same. This is corporate tax rate, so I'm not trying to fool anybody, and everybody ranks these around the country every year. Well, we all know that corporate taxes sometimes are a number, and sometimes are a number minus 500 different exemptions. And so they might not be fair to put someone one place or another, because if you take the Tax Foundation's overall rankings and you plot them against performance, what you end up is a chart that doesn't have any correlations on it. So it's important from a competitive standpoint to look at everything, to look at your labor availability, to look at, all types of exemptions within your taxation system, to look at infrastructure. Data can fool you quickly. And that was the point about data analytics beginning to rule the world, is that we have to be a little stronger with the way we look at things and present things, because everybody's got data that they're using to look at this these days. So competitiveness remains, but some things are going to change. We're going to see people trying really hard to figure out what it is that makes you or your state more or less exposed to the coronavirus. This was one that came out this week. It's one I'm not a particularly good fan of their methodology, but they tried to measure based on data that ended last month, what it is that causes the coronavirus to impact economies. And they used a lot of different data. I think that looking at a state where you have, especially in the South, where we have places, you know, like Tennessee, where Memphis and Nashville have completely different economies, or Charlotte and Raleigh in North Carolina have completely different economies. They're going to have different impacts different ways. So I think a better way to look at this, the Center for Economic Policy Research looked at industry supply and demand shocks by industry. And they're not, this makes common sense. The entertainment, restaurant, hotel industry, we know got a heavy hit. You have both a demand and a supply shock. We know that transport took a major hit. But a lot of industries yet have not taken huge hits, as you saw with some of the numbers, and are likely to bounce back pretty quickly. Another way of looking at this is looking at the occupations. And this is a big, messy chart. So the wages of the occupations are by the colors. So the purples and the orange are the lower wage jobs. And if you look down here where the biggest hits are, again, it makes sense. Dining room attendants, dishwashers, cooks, food prep, you know, clerks, managers at hotels. Those are the areas that took the biggest hits overall and the ones that are, they're going to be the slowest to bounce back overall. You think about the disruption, we've always had a very disruptive economy with things coming and going. But here's an example for you. At Amazon, I know, up 175,000 employees since we started this. Grubhub never had better business. Airbnb probably never had worse business. And American Airlines, even though someone on one of the calls this week talked about flying full flights, but the number of flights are really low. And so you're looking at industries that are going to be disrupted, were already being disrupted, going to be disrupted faster, and you're going to have real changes. You know, Amazon, over the last quarter, sales are up 22%, and Nordstrom sales are down 40%. There's going to be a shaking out that happens in the retail sector. We're also going to have talent wars that continue. It's easy to think back just a few months, and every one of you were talking about your talent. And I've had some calls about, well, with everybody being laid off and some of the jobs eliminated, should we worry about talent going forward? And the answer is yes, absolutely. You're going to have fewer people go back in the labor market because they're going to be afraid to send their kids to school. You're going to see more homeschooling. They're going to be afraid to put grandma in the nursing home again because they didn't get to see her. They're going to keep her home. And we're going to see labor market participation rates drop. At the same time, businesses are going to spend a great deal of time automating over the next few years, and we're going to need more skilled workers. And nobody got skilled during this period. So all of the skill concerns you had before this are going to be just as strong after this. And it does, the long run, unfortunately, looks even worse. We've been producing labor force at the lowest rate in our history, and the demographers are projecting that during this crisis, and I'll go ahead and tell you, I didn't know if people staying home meant that there'd be more babies in 9 months. Turns out they expect them to be 500,000 to 1 million less children born this year because of the crisis and the recession associated with it. So even seeding the forwardness of a forward labor force looks like it's going to be pretty low. We're talking a lot these days about whether people are going to move out of big cities to smaller places. Are they scared? And in the Northeast and the West, they were already experiencing this. New York and LA, Chicago were already seeing people leave before COVID. So there was already a flight out of larger cities from domestic migration. Whether or not they move into smaller places, I think, is still to be determined. But over the last 10 years, cities over 1 million were already shrinking, and cities under 100,000 were already shrinking. It was the middle-sized cities that were growing so fast. And I think that it's possible that people will spread out a little more. Certainly, there was a trend out of the city to suburbia for the last 2 or 3 years, that I think will be accentuated over the next few years. Remote everything is the name for the future. remote work. Everybody's not going to go work from home, but a bunch more people are than did before. Remote banking, remote exercise, home delivery of groceries, entertainment. Telemedicine has exploded. There's been some talk among the healthcare industry that telemedicine jumped 10 years in 10 weeks. That people are, you know, the rules have been rewritten. They've ignored things that they thought were barriers, and telemedicine now becomes what we all talk about. And robots, if you're in the manufacturing sector or the service sector, you're trying to figure out now how to add more robots because they can't be subject to stay-at-home orders and they don't get sick. And so especially in the retail area, the home health there, senior care, those type of areas, in order that you're trying to figure out, how do I keep my business open, running it electronically? Do I have an Amazon store that has no workers in it? Do I have a whatever? Expect robot, both the production of robots and the deployment of robots to rule us in the future. We already knew that the risk of being automated was down at that group of jobs that we talked about earlier, office support and food prep and some production and transport. Well, the accelerated automation is probably going to push us forward quite a few years. For us in the South, though, one of the things that is going to impact us more than we might imagine is what's going on globally. There's a great deal of turmoil before we started all this. We were talking about Brexit. We were talking about Hong Kong. And yesterday, China passed the law that everybody was fighting over. We were talking about the expansion of China in the South China Sea. All of those things have quietly progressed swiftly while we were, we and most of the world had our eye on the COVID virus. As we move forward, geopolitics is going to change. After the 2008 recession, 2007-8, what was going on with globalization slowed dramatically. You can see in the chart where the blue line diverges. There's a question of what will happen after this, but a lot of people believe that globalization will again slow dramatically. And that matters a lot to us in the South for the positive and the negative. Positive side is that we're going to reshore some industries. Whether it's reshoring to America or nearshoring to Mexico, there's going to be a lot of shifts in pharma, medical devices, the defense industry, and the food industry. Supply chains are going to get shorter, they're going to get redundant, and as a logistics powerhouse here in the South, we're going to be paying a lot of attention to those types of things. Exports per capita, we lead the country and regions. Foreign trade, foreign direct investment have been huge for this region, and it's an area where we're going to have to try to take advantage of some of those supply chain opportunities. If you look at exports across the South, there's a lot of places that really focus on exports, but you know your economies, and the rules of exporting will be something that'll change also, and we'll have to deal with that. As a chamber director, one of the things you're probably getting asked a lot about is small businesses. And the U.S. Census Bureau did a pulse for small businesses, a survey they started in the end of April. The bad news is that most small businesses still see COVID-19 as a huge negative for their business. We hear on television or in the media about the companies that have figured out how to use this to their advantage. And there are some, and that's good news, but the number where there's a positive, either a moderate or positive advantage to small business is still 4%. So overwhelmingly, small businesses are impacted negatively. The estimates that I see suggest that something around a quarter of all small businesses probably won't make it to reopening, and then maybe even more won't make it after the first year. Durable goods manufacturing has a long road back because a lot of that is in transportation, both cars and airplanes. Airplane orders are expected to be throttled back for most of the next decade. Car orders and truck orders are expected to be slow in the comeback. So we're going to see some plants have to dial back some of their expansion plans, some maybe stopping a shift here and there. When you look at our consumer, income and spending was about as expected in January and February, and then March, as COVID hit, income started down and spending started down. In April, you see the big jump. The government checks got there and incomes went up, but people were still afraid and spending stayed down. This past month in May, the overall income started dropping again, but people started spending a little more. And so you're starting to see a thawing with some of the consumers. And that's really the question. This is a chart that shows that lower income individuals actually are back to almost spending everything again, everything they have. It's the high income individuals that are still continuing to save, and savings rates are still very high. People are hoarding their cash, not knowing what the future holds. The key to recovery for all of us is consumer sentiment. And unfortunately, over the last 2 weeks, consumer sentiment in the South that was rising has flattened out. And as you go forward on this, I think the last few weeks are not going to, you're not going to help this any. And so consumer sentiment going forward will help determine how much money is going back in. I think that the real fear for a lot of people is that consumers usually don't make rational decisions. I could stop there, but you know, at least in practice, they don't make rational decisions when they have ambiguous information. And right now, we all know that there's sort of an information tug of war going on nationally. So consumers, you know, where they're going to move, how much money they plan to save, how far, and whether they'll travel to work or home, what vacations they take, those are all hard to predict because consumers right now are facing a real dilemma in trying to understand what to believe. The next problem, though, is that will that fear and uncertainty begin to change some of their moral judgments on economic policy? And we're seeing nationally now that there's the polarization that's happening between arguments on equity and opportunity and access are taking center stage against what have been growth and efficiency discussions for a long time. And so I think that consumers are worth watching because what they do with economy that's two-thirds driven by consumption is going to be the key as we go forward. Businesses, on the other hand, they know they've got a global pandemic. They know they're in the middle of a global recession. The ones I talk to are pretty concerned that both domestic and geopolitics are unpredictable at this moment. And now the polarization and equity or the riots we were talking about yesterday in the Midwest, they're beginning to have an impact on business risk. And so businesses are trying to manage what for many of them is unprecedented risk, certainly in the last decade. But that risk right now, none of these are slowing down at the moment. Risk stays high and businesses tend to not like making decisions in those risk times. If you're trying to figure out when that light at the end of the tunnel gets big and bright, it took 6 years to get back to the job numbers from the 2007-08 recession. Today, if you're trying to figure out what the design is, I think most, if we get through, you know, to the vaccine level, a lot of our economy will come back immediately. There'll be a pretty steep V. But then we lost a lot of jobs permanently. The Congressional Budget Office estimates a little over 11 million, and they're projecting full recovery not for 10 years, till 2030. So that initial V, it won't be a long swoosh because a whole bunch will come back as we open, but over time, there's gonna be a slowness to get back to 100% of where we were. Lou's asked me that every quarter we try to focus on something different, and so we're going to do that. We'll try to deal with Mark's question and look a little closer at how productivity and output and population demographics and industry sectors work. But we're also going to look at educational requirements for jobs over the next rest of this year. We're going to look at tech sector employment growth, where it is, what sectors it's in, and where it's projected to be. And we'll also look at some other relationships like between crime rates and poverty and other socioeconomic things, just so that you have that kind of data to use as you see fit. For me, I think the biggest unknowns now is that we don't know a lot. You know, when you're asked, when do things get better? When do things happen? There's a lot about the virus we don't know. There's a lot about public thought that we don't know. And there's certainly a lot about political decisions that are yet to be made. I think in the short run, we're all going to be riding through a pretty bad storm. But the U.S. is still the most competitive country in the world. Your states will go back to being their competitiveness, wherever that was on the continuum when we're done. And the ideas of cost structure and labor and mitigating risk are still going to be important to all your businesses. So it's a good time to try to deal with some of those issues through your legislature. Happy to answer questions for the rest of the time. Lou and Kathy will make the slides available to everyone, and look forward to the questions that you'll have today.
Hey, Lou, Ted, this is Randy.
Yep.
Let me ask a question. You know, we spent a lot of time in Arkansas focused on education, especially career and technical ed.
Yep.
Do you see anybody across the country doing an exceptional job of taking advantage of this sort of a pause in economic activity to reskill and upskill people that are unemployed? Has anybody been smart about this so far?
Randy, so I got that question yesterday too. I don't know of anybody. Part of the problem is that in the middle of all of this, most of our education institutions were paralyzed. They're all closed. So it's been almost impossible to do that. I don't think that any of the private institutions have done much out there in this. I think that some legislative things have happened. Some people have managed to get licensing things, reciprocal licensing between states done. They've managed to get certificate programs approved for colleges when they come back that are shorter and cheaper, those kind of things. But I haven't seen anybody who's made a major push, and I don't see everything. So maybe some other people on the call know it, but mostly higher ed, both community colleges and colleges, universities have just been on dead stop trying to figure out how you teach kids online and worried like hell that they're not going to get kids back in the fall. And if they do, they're going to send them all home, and then most of them do not have those kind of buffers. So the private schools are scared to death. The public schools don't know what the legislators are going to do. So that's mostly been on their mind.
Thank you.
Questions?
Hey, Ted, I'll throw one out there. I know the last two calls, just sort of the macro public policy implications of what you've discussed today. You know, if you're a southern state, based on the data you've seen here, what kind of things might you be thinking about in your state to kind of, get competitive, stay competitive, increase competitive advantage?
I think the big opportunity going forward is going to be in the supply chain networks for our manufacturers across the South. I think we got into this discussion pretty deeply on one of the calls yesterday. China doesn't look near as attractive as she used to look for our supply chains. Mexico still looks pretty attractive, and it still has about a 30% cost differential. But the people I talk to says Mexico doesn't have trained labor. So there's going to be a struggle for being able to deliver trained labor. You might remember we don't have any trained manufacturing labor either. If you think all the way back to December of last year when I was out interviewing manufacturers, they couldn't find workers that had the skills they needed. So maybe a few of them can be retrained, but there is real opportunity if we can find labor to shore up those supply chains. And so I think that especially in biopharma and medical device and heavy machinery and anything related to defense, we're going to wake up pretty soon and understand that our defense industry is dependent on way too many connections. And so I think that that's part of it. I think Randy asked the right question about labor is, can we go back and create a bounty system for our community colleges that shorten time frames and make them affordable? Somebody asked Lou yesterday too, you remember, about, you know, is everybody off trying to shorten those supply chains already? And the answer I gave was, I think that they're waiting for the federal government to send a couple signals. In Japan and India and other places, their national governments have used incentives, used some of their stimulus money to incent their bringing back their supply chains. There's some discussion of that in DC, but it hadn't happened quite yet. The infrastructure bill that would allow more efficiency for some of our manufacturing has not passed yet. So I think we're waiting on the next round of incentives, if there's such a thing, or stimulus from DC. Everything I hear says that everybody's still working on things, but there's no consensus. So I think the labor, infrastructure, and supply chains are probably the things that are most there. And then on the other side, some of you know that you know, there's a tug of war going on ways to get labor back to work. And I think that's going to be a struggle this fall. Don't know how the health stuff is going to play into that, but it is hard to convince someone that they need to go back to work until they need to. And maybe they don't, given the infusion of capital into some budgets. Who else has got a good question today?
Hey, Ted, it's Mark. All the conversation going on about social justice, you know, especially in the last month after George Floyd, you know, you've sort of been there and seen a lot and done a lot. And, you know, right now we have the uncertainty of the pandemic and the uncertainty of a global recession and the uncertainty of a presidential year. And that's going to be interesting. And, you know, and we have this, you know, social justice, racial inequality conversation going on. How does a state chamber, you know, how do we all stay focused right now on, you talked at the beginning about, or Lou talked about competitiveness. How do we, you know, when you have so many different issues coming at us right now, you know, how do you make sense of it? Because you could focus on one and lose focus on all the others, right? Yep. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah. So I think that most businesses have now had about 3 months to try to figure out their health and safety issues. And I think that the ones that are the considerable size businesses are still worried because they don't have answers, but they're trying to figure that out. Everybody presumes that a recession gets over at some point and you hunker down, you ride it out. I think the social unrest issues scare a great many of our businesses. I started my career in Baltimore in 1980. That was 12 years after the 68 riots in Baltimore. And I was a North Carolina kid going to big city, and that's all they wanted to talk about. Businesses, every time in economic development, if you talked about someone coming into the city, that's all they wanted to hear is how would you protect us from this, that, or something else. And I remember having to really read a lot about that history because that history was reality for all of those businesses. So I think that there's a new, one of the real estate people has a new report out today that said that in the first quarter of this year, 99% of all office absorption happened in suburban America. Didn't happen in central business districts. I think you're going to see that shift back to suburban America some. So that's an immediate thing. But I think that the confluence of sort of the equity and morality issues, as they get all together, businesses are sort of staking themselves out. This is what we believe. And if you don't believe us, then, you know, your customers go here and there. I think that division is long-term dangerous for everybody. I don't particularly want to have to know what the business view is on whether or not I buy their lace-up shoes. I don't want to not go to Chick-fil-A because they said something and go to Popeyes because they said something else. I think that's a really odd business system. And I think major companies are struggling heavily with that. You've seen a lot try to get out in the future on that. LinkedIn had was running a poll, or Twitter, I don't know, this week on how their readers, what they believe that businesses ought to be involved in. Should they be involved in social issues? And I think the answer was by, you know, 3/4, yes, they should. But the broader thing was in the comments, which is from younger people who partake of those types of social media, that they wouldn't be dealing or working for a business that didn't. I think that's the real struggles you're getting into, is what is the expectation of business, and then how does that divide their customer base? So I think it's still here to stay. I don't know if this one, you know, we had an Occupy Wall Street a few years ago that was hot for a few minutes and then wasn't. This one, at least to me, feels like it might have some sticking power. And so I think that it's certainly worth the antennas being up on, and making sure that your board and you guys are aligned on where you stand on issues, because you're going to get asked and they're going to get asked.
Ted?
Yes.
We have a question from Carolyn Johnson. Do you see it there? How has the $600 extra in unemployment comp impacted GDP and spending during the pandemic?
So it doesn't impact GDP yet, because it doesn't impact the output of the individual. But for spending, for lower income workers, it's helped. They've spent. So you've seen the numbers jump back up on spending. And so it was supposed to be a stimulus, and it was. The lower the worker, lower wage the worker, the more likely they were to spend it on basics like housing and food. But it has been in there. I think what it'll do for a long time is change the income numbers. So average incomes will have this odd bump this year, because the lower end of your income spectrum will have gotten a little wealthier. Part of that will have to do with what happens in the second half of the year, because I don't see it being extended right now. I think that would be my tea leaf read of Washington, that you won't see an extension of unemployment insurance at the federal level. You certainly might see it at some states, but if y'all know something different, I'd love to hear it. But I think that's the way I read it. I don't think the Senate will vote that at this point. But that $600 did hit the system, and you know, there's still some percentage of people who still don't have their $1,200. And you might see, I think there's some discussion in D.C. about back to work bonuses and other things. You might see some more stimulus in there that would impact it. But nothing on GDP yet, but definitely something on income and spending. Anybody else?
Ted, it's Mark Wilson again. If nobody else is going to jump in, I'll take the time. I really appreciate working with you. I know we do a couple projects together, and today's not the first time I've heard you answer one of our questions with, it depends, and it depends on if you want to be a business or a chamber president. So, you know, for state chamber presidents who, you know, most of us started the year having a record year, and most of us are going to end the year having a record year, right? Just a little different kind. And you know, if you were the president of a state chamber trying to generate interest and membership revenue for the second half of 2020, what would your pitch be? What would you be out talking to companies about?
I would probably be talking to them that if I were you, Mark, I would be telling them that you know, my legislature and governor are asking me what they need to do to help businesses, and I've got their ear. You tell me what to do. You stay close to me, and I will provide that advice. So if you've got a good relationship, several of you I see on the screen have those relationships. Nobody knows what to do. You know, every now and then our legislators and governors act like they understand business, but there's nobody that has a better pulse, or should have a better pulse, on what your businesses are thinking, afraid of, or want than you do. And so you're that conduit to them. That means for the most part, you're representing a subset of the businesses in the state. So I think that would be the first thing I would do is sell that. The second thing I would do is sell the things that are important to the businesses at that moment. So right now, you know, in many states, safety is terribly important, trying to open back up, trying to be the good guy. I would also sell that, and Lou and I've had this discussion before, if we have a national discussion about the role of business and what business, whether business is good for society or bad for society, y'all have seen some of the stuff that goes around. And I think the last time I was down at Marco Island with you, there was a good report on, you know, how people view businesses. This is a time where businesses, the public sentiment is precarious. This is a time for you to lead that charge of business, you know, helping society, being part of it. And I'm not talking about having a social agenda. I'm talking about having an agenda to keep you safe, keep people working, keep people employed, keep families fed, all that stuff. So I would sell those auxiliary things too. But main thing I would sell is the legislative and executive branch access of ideas and try to do awesome. That.
Thank you.
Sure.
I think I would just sort of add to Ted's comment, Mark. I think as I'm talking to folks around the country, I think the Mark or Randy recovery plan for your state has a lot of selling power. And I think businesses are hungry for a direction and a plan that they want to help you and Randy and Ashley and others on the call be successful. And I think that's a big part of what I think folks are talking about as well. State chambers are uniquely positioned to have a plan to do that. And I think the ones that are stepping forward and talking about that plan aggressively are seeing great success.
And Lou, I'd add, you and I have talked about this too. You can't all be the voice of fear and doom all the time. You have to also be the voice of opportunity. You know, what is it that we can do as a state to come out of this stronger, not less weak? And so you have to have some optimism, reality based, but still optimism that there is a future that is good. Both citizens and business leaders, everybody wants to believe that things are going to get better and could even get even better if you just did a few things. So to Lou's point, that those pathways are the things that create optimism in people, and that's sellable also.
Any additional questions for Ted? Okay, well, this has been a great first session. As I mentioned, we'll be doing these three times a year. I want to thank all of you, first of all, for taking time to be on the call today. I know you get pulled a lot to be on Zoom calls, and we're living on them, and thanks for giving us 60 minutes. Also want to thank Michelle Wheeler and the folks at Next Era Energy for sponsoring this presentation and being a sponsor of the council. Also, our friends that participate are hosting the platform that will deliver all this information to you into the Council of State Chamber website soon. Also want to thank Ted Abernathy for serving as our National Economic Advisor for the Council for 2020. And as I mentioned, all the content will be available for you to use, share with your staff, share with board members, put it on your website. I think it's all designed to give you the knowledge you need to be smart about your region, about your state. And as we talked about on this call, how do you make some smart choices about improving your competitiveness and take advantage of the opportunity of this crisis, because it will come to an end. And I think with this kind of information and folks like Ted, they're giving us the information we need to take full advantage of that opportunity. So thanks again for being with us, and be safe, and look forward to seeing you soon.
Hey, Lou, this is Randy. Quick comment. Thanks to you and Ted both. I appreciate the scale of these, rather than a group of, you know, a small intimate group of 200 or 300. I really like the fact that you can get in and get a question and get some feedback.
Wonderful. Well,
well done.
And with your feedback, keep making it better. So thanks, Randy.
You bet.